Knowledge Products presents The Giants of Philosophy. David Hume, narrated by Charlton Heston. Part 7.
All modern philosophers, beginning with Descartes, started their inquiries by analyzing the contents of their consciousness. This approach reflects the modern tendency to look inward for standards.
I will suppose that the sky, the air, the earth, colors, figures, sounds, and all external things are nothing better than the illusions of dreams. I will consider myself as without hands, eyes, flesh, blood, or any of the senses, and as falsely believing that I am possessed of these. I readily discover that there is nothing more easily or clearly apprehended than my own mind.
Hume's predecessor, John Locke, published one of the most influential analyses of the contents of our consciousness. He wanted to show that all of our knowledge comes to us from experience, both external and internal. Locke's approach to explaining knowledge is known as empiricism, the attempt to find knowledge in experience only, and not in rational or logical speculation.
All ideas come from sensation and reflection. Let us then suppose the mind to be, as we say, white paper, void of all characters, without any ideas. How comes it to be furnished? Whence comes it by that vast store which the busy and boundless fancy of man has painted on it with an almost endless variety? Whence has it all the materials of reason and knowledge? To this I answer in one word: from experience.
Hume's epistemology, his theory of knowledge and how we know what we know, actually shows the limitations of empiricism. Hume begins his treatise of human nature in typically modern fashion by analyzing what's in our consciousness.
All the perceptions of the human mind resolve themselves into two distinct kinds, which I shall call impressions and ideas.
Impressions are immediate experiences caused either by external objects or internal bodily processes. Ideas are the afterimages or thoughts we have about our immediate experiences. Hume then proceeds to divide ideas into simple and complex. A simple idea cannot be broken down further into parts. A complex idea can be analyzed into simpler ones. Having identified simple ideas, like the idea of the color blue, Hume announces his first principle.
All our simple ideas in their first appearance are derived from simple impressions, which are correspondent to them and which they exactly represent.
What he means, quite simply, is that we can't have simple ideas unless we've had the corresponding impression or original experience. Congenitally blind people do not have the idea of color because they've never seen color. If someone has never tasted a pineapple, he can't really form an idea of what it tastes like. So Hume's view sounds like it repeats Locke's empiricism. It seems to try to trace every idea to an original experience. But the direct correspondence between idea and impression breaks down as soon as we come to complex ideas. Some complex ideas don't correspond to a direct impression. For example, my idea of the city of Paris is associated with an indefinite series of images and memories. What's more, some complex ideas can't be understood simply by directly referring to our experience. Here's where Hume starts to veer away from empiricism. Some of our complex ideas can be explained only by taking into account the creative and organizing activity of the mind. The mind can impose order on simple ideas and create new complexes out of them. This is what Hume calls the association of ideas. Hume says in his abstract that the doctrine of the association of ideas, the doctrine that the creative power of the mind organizes our experience, is his great discovery.
If anything can entitle the author to so glorious a name as that of an inventor, it is the use he makes of the principle of the association of ideas, which enters into most of his philosophy. Our imagination has a great authority over our ideas, and there are no ideas that are different from each other which it cannot separate and join and compose into all varieties of fiction. But there is a secret tie or union among particular ideas which causes the mind to conjoin them more frequently together and makes the one, upon its appearance, introduce the other.
Hume then enumerates the three principal operations of the imagination.
These principles of association are reduced to three: resemblance, contiguity, causation.
Notice that causation or causal thinking is one of the three fundamental tenets for organizing our experience. Recall how a correct understanding of causal reasoning is very important to Hume.
It will be easy to conceive of what vast consequence these principles must be in the science of human nature if we consider that, so far as we regard the mind, these are the only links that bind the parts of the universe together, or connect us with any person or object exterior to ourselves. For, as it is by means of thought only that anything operates upon our passions, and as these are the only ties of our thoughts, they are really, to us, the cement of the universe, and all the operations of the mind must, in a great measure, depend on them.
Hume earlier had distinguished between memory and imagination. Memory preserves the identical order of our previous experience. Otherwise, we wouldn't call it memory. The imagination has the power to reorganize our ideas, and this explains the creative element in human intelligence. Before the 18th century, writers like Locke had treated the imagination in a pejorative way. They ascribed to it all of our errors and follies. But starting with Hume, the imagination's taken on a new and positive meaning. Hume claims to discover that the imagination is not haphazard, but proceeds according to principles which he calls natural relations. It instinctively responds to our experience. What's most important philosophically in all this is that Hume ascribes a creative power to the mind. Now, human knowledge can't be explained in any simplistic, empiricist way. Our knowledge is not just a mere reflection of some external structure. It's structured by the creative power of the imagination. What we take from experience is less important than the imagination we bring to it. One example will bring out Hume's revolution in understanding how we think. The principle of induction is the principle that the future will resemble the past. A general rule is induced from repeatedly observing some events or objects. So we all presume that the sun will rise again tomorrow, that fire burns the skin. In short, that the world is an orderly and predictable place. All science presumes that there are laws of nature which express this regularity. Recall that in order to use causal reasoning, Hume says we must have constant conjunction, or a history of regularity. So he asks this question: why do we believe that the future will resemble the past?
When it is asked, what is the nature of all our reasonings concerning matter of fact? The proper answer seems to be that they are founded on the relation of cause and effect. When again it is asked, what is the foundation of all our reasonings and conclusions concerning that relation? It may be replied in one word: experience. But if we still carry on our sifting humor and ask, what is the foundation of all conclusions from experience? This implies a new question.
The answer to this new question is traditionally called the principle of induction. In Hume's words, the foundation of all conclusions from experience is
the supposition that the future will be conformable to the past.
But Hume wants to know the source of authority for this principle.
Though none but a fool or madman will ever pretend to dispute the authority of experience, or to reject that great guide of human life, it may surely be allowed a philosopher to have so much curiosity, at least as to examine the principle of human nature, which gives this mighty authority to experience, and makes us draw the advantage from that similarity which nature has placed among different objects.
Hume's argument discredits those rationalistic philosophers who believe theoretical reason is the great source of knowledge. that reason is the authoritative guide to human life. We've already seen how Hume often attacks the pretensions of theoretical reason. He now attacks the specific principle of induction in a similar way. According to Hume, there are two types of theoretical reason. There are relations of ideas and matters of fact.
All the objects of human reason or inquiry may naturally be divided into two kinds, relations of ideas and matters of fact. Of the first kind are the sciences of geometry, algebra, and arithmetic. Propositions of this kind are discoverable by the mere operation of thought, without dependence on what is anywhere existent in the universe. That 3 times 5 is equal to the half of 30 expresses a relation.
By a relation of ideas, Hume means a truth that doesn't depend on experience, for which we can't conceive an opposite. An example of this relation of ideas can be seen in the statement that a triangle has 3 sides. We didn't discover this truth by examining triangles. It's based on the meaning of the concepts involved, which are independent of experience. If someone claimed to discover a triangle with more than 3 sides, we'd simply say it's not a triangle. We can't conceive of a triangle as being anything other than 3-sided. Otherwise, we're not thinking about a triangle. But matters of fact are different. These truths are based on experience, and we can see how its opposite may be true. We can imagine what it would be like if the sun did not rise tomorrow. We would all wake up in darkness. But even if we can imagine it, we don't have to believe it'll happen.
Matters of fact are not ascertained in the same manner. The contrary of every matter of fact is still possible.
If this principle of induction, this presumption that the future will resemble the past, were justified by theoretical reason, then induction would have to be either a relation of ideas or a matter of fact. Hume proceeds to argue that the principle of induction is neither of these, that therefore reason is not the authority behind the principle of induction. In the first place, the principle of induction is not a relation of ideas. We know this because we can imagine and conceive of its opposite, a future that does not resemble the past.
That the sun will not rise tomorrow is no less intelligible a proposition and implies no more a contradiction than the affirmation that it will rise. We should in vain, therefore, attempt to demonstrate its falsehood.
In the second place, the principle of induction is not a matter of fact discovered through experience. Why haven't we learned from experience that the future will resemble the past? The simple answer is that our experience is always of the past, never of the future. The most our experience can show is that the world was and perhaps is an orderly place. But experience by its very nature can't show that the world will be in the future an orderly place. Our experience is always interpreted in a way that assumes the future will resemble the past. We can't appeal to experience to describe the future because we would then be arguing in a circle.
All inferences from experience suppose as their foundation that the future will resemble the past, and that similar powers will be conjoined with similar sensible qualities. If there be any suspicion that the course of nature may change, and that the past may be no rule for the future, all experience becomes useless, and can give rise to no inference or conclusion. It is impossible, therefore, that any arguments from experience can prove this resemblance of the past to the future, since all these arguments are founded on the supposition of that resemblance. To endeavor, therefore, the proof of this last supposition by probable arguments must be evidently going in a circle, and taking that for granted, which is the very point in question.
It should be clear that theoretical reason, in either of its forms, can't support our belief that the future will resemble the past. It also should be clear that Hume isn't like the empiricist John Locke. He doesn't explain our fundamental beliefs by simply appealing to experience. Does that mean that Hume has no answer?
You mistake the purport of my question. As an agent, I am quite satisfied in the point. But as a philosopher, who has some share of curiosity, I will not say skepticism, I want to learn the foundation of this inference.
Hume does provide an answer. We've been having such difficulty all along because we've been assuming, perhaps unconsciously, that the principle of induction, again, the view that the future will resemble the past, is an alleged truth about the world. According to Hume, it's not a truth about the world. It's a truth about how we, as human beings, think about the world. Over and over again, Hume explains our experience by appealing to how the mind organizes experience. The structure of what we know doesn't come to us from outside. Rather, it's something that comes from the inside, from the association of ideas. As Hume expresses it, custom is what explains our reasoning.
There is some other principle which determines him to form such a conclusion. This principle is custom or habit. Custom, then, is the great guide of human life. It is that principle alone which renders our experience useful to us and makes us expect for the future a similar train of events with those which have appeared in the past. Without the influence of custom, we should be entirely ignorant of every matter of fact beyond what is immediately present to the memory or senses. We should never know how to adjust means to ends, or to employ our natural powers in the production of any effect. There would be an end at once of all action, as well as of the chief part of speculation.
Hume tells us that custom explains our reasoning, that it's the great guide of human life. But one of the curious things about Hume's solution is that he calls it a skeptical solution. This terminology has been a great source of confusion. In modern times, since Descartes, the term skeptic has been used to refer to a negative position, the position of someone who declares that rational justification is impossible. But in classical times, there were different sorts of skeptics. One of Hume's heroes was the ancient academic skeptic, Sextus Empiricus. Sextus had argued that where theoretical reason is impotent, mankind has to rely upon practical knowledge, common sense, and custom to solve its problems. Academic skepticism was a positive alternative to the pretensions of theoretical reason. Hume is a skeptic in the classical academic sense. He advocates custom and common sense rather than theoretical reason. From Hume's point of view, the entire history of philosophy is full of bad arguments, all of which appeal to theoretical reason.
It is easy for one of judgment and learning to perceive the weak foundation, even of those systems which have obtained the greatest credit and have carried their pretensions highest to accurate and profound reasoning. Principles taken upon trust, consequences lamely deduced from them, want of coherence in the parts, and of evidence in the whole. These are everywhere to be met with in the systems of the most eminent philosophers, and seem to have drawn disgrace upon philosophy itself.
As an alternative, Hume suggests a new definition for philosophy.
Philosophy is common sense, methodized and corrected.
How did people respond to Hume's revolution in thinking? As we've already noted, Hume was at first ignored, then misunderstood, and finally misrepresented. One of Hume's most sympathetic interpreters, Norman Kemp Smith, has put it as follows.
It is a very remarkable historical fact that notwithstanding the clearness and cogency of Hume's argument and the appearance of such competent thinkers as Thomas Reed in Scotland, no less than 30 years should have elapsed before Hume found a single reader capable of appreciating the teaching of the treatise at its true value.
Kemp Smith's referring to none other than Immanuel Kant, the greatest and most influential modern German philosopher. Kant describes his first experience on reading Hume as follows.
David Hume's teaching first interrupted my dogmatic slumber and gave my investigation in the field of speculative philosophy a quite new direction.
Kant was Hume's only equal in 18th century philosophy, so he was in a good position to comment on why Hume was systematically misunderstood and why Hume's critics thought of him as a negative and destructive skeptic.
But the perpetual hard fate of metaphysics would not allow Hume to be understood. We cannot, without a certain sense of pain, consider how utterly his opponents, Reed, Oswald, Beattie, and even Priestley, missed the point of the problem. For while they were ever assuming as conceded what he doubted, and demonstrating with eagerness and often with arrogance what he never thought of disputing, they so overlooked his inclination towards a better state of things that everything remained undisturbed in its old condition.
What Kant understood, and Hume's opponents did not, was that Hume had given an entirely new orientation to Western thought. Previous philosophers had tried in vain to understand the world outside of the individual as if that world made sense on its own. Hume and Kant as well came to understand that the philosopher's task is to try to understand mankind. To them, only by understanding human beings can we understand the world. What we think of as an objective world is largely a world seen through our own eyes. It's impossible to speculate on how the world would look from outside human consciousness. Humanity is condemned always to look at the world from its own perspective. There's no other perspective available. Immanuel Kant went on to call this new perspective a Copernican revolution in philosophy. He drew an analogy between Hume and himself on the one hand and Copernicus on the other. Before Copernicus, it had been thought that the sun and the heavens rotated around the earth. After Copernicus, we came to recognize that motion is relative and that the earth rotates around the sun. The earth participates in the drama of the heavens. Likewise, in philosophy, philosophers before Hume thought that knowledge was to be found in the search for an objective and external reality. But after Hume and Kant, philosophers came to recognize that the structure of knowledge comes from within mankind. We are part of what we know, not mere spectators of what is known.
This is the end of Part 7. Please download Part 8 to continue.